There's a famous story about Pablo Picasso. You've probably heard it.
Yeah.
He visits the Lascaux Caves in France.
Right after they were discovered back in 1940.
Exactly. So he goes deep into the cave, sees these majestic paintings of bulls and horses that are something like 20,000 years old, and he walks out, just apparently shaken.
And he supposedly says, "Since Lascaux, we have invented nothing."
Yeah.
It's a powerful quote. And, you know, even if it's a bit of a legend, the sentiment is completely dead on. It captures that vertigo you get when you realize ancient doesn't mean primitive.
Right, we have this cartoon in our heads of, grunting cavemen banging rocks
Your
together.
Fred Flintstone version of history.
Yeah, that if their technology was stone, their minds must have been simple, blunt.
And that is exactly the idea we're going to dismantle today. Because when you actually look at the source material, the archaeology, the microscopic analysis, you don't find simpletons. You find the invention of perspective, the first cinematic animation.
It's incredible. So the mission for this deep dive is clear. We want to figure out who these people really were. Why, when survival was so hard, did they spend thousands of hours making things that had, zero practical use?
That is the million-dollar question. Evolution is ruthless. Usually, if you waste energy, you die. So for art to exist this early, it must have had a function just as important as a spear or a fire.
Well, let's start there then with the tools, because I was looking at the notes on this one-hand axe from Spain, the Excalibur
Yes,
axe.
the pit of bones.
Cima de los Huesos. I mean, even the name sounds ominous. So they found this pit, and it's just packed with the remains of Homo heidelbergensis, an ancestor of ours, from about 350,000 years
A
ago.
long, long time ago.
And right in the middle of all these bones, there's one single-hand axe. But this wasn't your standard issue chopper, was it?
No, and this is where the details really matter. Almost all the tools in that region were made of, standard flint or limestone. But Excalibur is made of red quartzite.
Well, which is rare there.
Extremely rare. You'd have to go way out of your way to find it and then craft it.
Okay, but couldn't it just be that this one guy found a cool rock? Maybe he was the chief, wanted a flashy axe. Does that really mean it's art?
That's a fair challenge. But here's the smoking gun. The wear patterns, or really the lack of them. When you analyze the edge under a microscope, it's pristine. This thing never cut a piece of meat. It never scraped a hide.
So it was made just to be made.
It was made with incredible skill to be perfectly symmetrical, and then it was placed in a pit of bodies. This is the difference between a hammer in your toolbox and a silver hammer you put in a coffin.
It implies they weren't just thinking, how do I cut this deer? They were thinking about aesthetics, maybe the afterlife. They were attaching symbolic meaning to an object.
Precisely.
There's another thing about the tools that surprised me, the notes on flint knapping, the actual process of making them, and how dangerous it was. I just assumed you bang two rocks together.
Oh, not at all. It's an incredibly high-stakes craft. Modern anthropologists who try to recreate these tools get injured all the time.
Really?
Yeah, we're talking razor-sharp flakes of stone flying at your face.
Mm-hmm.
Without safety goggles, you risk blinding yourself. You can slice tendons, cut right down to the bone.
So why do it? If you just need a sharp edge, why make something perfectly symmetrical and beautiful if it risks your eyesight?
Well, this gets into something called the handicap principle. Think of a peacock's tail. It's heavy, it attracts predators,
Yep.
it's a terrible survival trait,
Right.
but the peacock grows it to say to the female, "Look at me, I'm so fit, so strong, I can afford this ridiculous handicap."
So a beautiful, dangerous to make hand axe is a prehistoric flex.
In a way, yeah, it signals to the group that you have the coordination, the patience, the fitness to take that risk and succeed. The beauty serves a social function.
That bridges the gap between tool and art really nicely.
Okay, let's jump forward in time a bit to about 16,000 years ago. There's this object, the faun with birds, spear thrower. First, what's a spear thrower? An atlatl. It's basically a lever for your arm, a stick with a hook on the end. It effectively lengthens your throwing arm, so you get massive leverage. You can throw a spear harder, faster, farther.
Okay, so it's a weapon, a force multiplier. But this specific one isn't just a stick. The handle is carved into this amazing little scene of a fawn looking backward at two birds.
It's a masterpiece of composition. But if you look really closely at the details, the faun has its tail raised and something is emerging from underneath.
Wait, it's giving birth.
It is. It's giving birth.
Yeah.
And the bird is perched on the birth membrane.
So you have a weapon designed to kill animals,
Right.
and on the handle, you've carved a scene of an animal being born.
Life and death in one object. It seems contradictory, doesn't it?
It's so poetic for a hunter to make, but the notes say this wasn't a one-off. It wasn't unique.
No, it wasn't. We've found fragments of other spear throwers with the exact same design, the same fawn, the same birds.
Which means what? People were copying it.
It means it was a shared culture. It wasn't just one creative genius. This image meant something to them as a group. It's kind of the earliest evidence of a brand or a cultural meme being passed around.
That flows right into the idea of branding ourselves. Let's talk jewelry. Because if a tool is survival and necklace is just vanity, right? Like,
is vanity just vanity? Or is it communication?
The sources mention sea snail shells from Morocco and South Africa dating way, way back, like 75,000 to 150,000 years ago.
Right. And again, the details are everything. Finding shells in a cave isn't weird. People ate snails. But these shells had holes punched in them, and microscopic analysis showed wear patterns.
From being strung on a cord?
From being strung on a cord or rubbing against clothing. They're wearing them. And here's the kicker. Some of these shells were found hundreds of kilometers from the ocean.
So they were traded.
Or carried on long migrations. They had value. But more than that, jewelry is the first time we see an external storage of information about the self. You know, you walk into a room today, your clothes, your watch, your wedding ring, they tell people who you are before you say a word.
I'm married, I'm wealthy, I'm part of this group.
Exactly. These shells were likely doing the same thing. I am part of the shell clan. I have high status. It's the grease that lets larger societies function. A social tracking system.
Okay, so we've got tools, we've got bling. Now I want to get into the really mind-bending stuff, the figurines. Let's start with the Lion Man of Hollensteinstädel.
The Löwenmensch, yes. This one is a heavy hitter. About 40,000 years old, carved from mammoth ivory.
And it's a human body with a lion's head.
Correct.
What gets me is the time investment. The researchers did an experiment and estimated it took 370 hours to carve this.
Just let that sink in. 370 hours, that's months of work for a few hours a day. In a hunter-gatherer society, if you're carving ivory for that long, you're not hunting.
Someone else was feeding you.
Exactly. The tribe decided this object was so important that they would support the artist. But intellectually, it's even bigger. A lion man doesn't exist in nature.
Right. You paint a bison because you see a bison. But to carve this, you have to invent it in your head.
It's the physical evidence of fiction, of myth. Mm. It means they were capable of imagining things that were physically impossible. That's the birth of religion, of storytelling, of everything.
Speaking of abstract, let's talk about the Venus figurines, these voluptuous, faceless women found all over Europe. The textbook answer is always fertility goddesses, which kind of feels like code for we have no idea.
Yeah, ritual purposes is the archaeologists get out of jail free card. And look, the fertility goddess theory isn't wrong necessarily, but there is a much more compelling theory that's gained ground.
The self-portrait theory.
Exactly. If you are a woman and you look down at your own body, what do you see? Your breasts look large, your stomach sticks out, your legs seem short and tapered, and you can't see your own face.
And that perfectly matches the proportions of the figurines.
It's a dead ringer. So maybe these aren't men carving goddesses. Maybe these are women documenting their own bodies.
I love that. But while we're on figurines, I have to ask about the exploding ceramics. This sounded like a prehistoric prank when I read it.
The Venus of Dolní Vistanice. This is from the Czech Republic about 30,000 years ago. Earliest known ceramic technology. But, and it's a big but, they didn't make cups or bowls. They made figurines.
And the clay was weird.
It was intentionally manipulated. They mixed it with crushed mammoth bone and other things that have different thermal expansion rates.
Okay, I remember this from science class. What happens when you mix stuff like that and throw it in a fire?
It explodes. Thermal shock. A regular clay pot might crack. These things pop with a loud bang and shatter into pieces.
And we don't think this was an accident.
No, because the kilns were filled with these fragments. The theory is that this was the point.
So imagine you're in a dark hut. The shaman holds up a figure, chants something, throws it in the fire, and bam, it explodes.
It's pyrotechnics. It suggests the act of destruction was the art. The performance was the point. It just adds such a human element. The love of a bang, the drama of a magic trick.
It really kills the stoic survivalist image. These people liked a show. Okay, speaking of shows, let's go to the cinema. The Caves, Lascaux and Chauvet.
The Sistine Chapels of prehistory.
And you don't just walk in the front door. Like, the experience of being there is part of it?
No, these are deep systems. You're crawling through tight tunnels for hundreds of meters sometimes. It's pitch black. The air can be low in oxygen, which might even induce hallucinations.
And all you have is a little lamp burning animal fat.
A flickering, unstable light. And that's crucial. We see these images in textbooks as flat, bright photos. That's not how they were meant to be seen.
You're talking about the animation. How do you animate a painting on a rock?
You use the flicker. In Chauvet, there are paintings of animals with eight legs, or multiple heads slightly overlapping. Under a steady electric light, it looks messy. But under a flickering torch,
the legs seem to move.
The animal appears to run or toss its head. It's proto-cinema. They were trying to capture time and motion.
That's just mind-blowing. And they were also playing with the shape of the rock itself,
yeah.
Right? Anamorphosis.
Yes. Like those 3D street paintings where it only looks right from one spot.
Right. From any other angle, it's a distorted mess.
They did that. They'd paint a bull high up on a curved wall, stretching the legs and body so that to you standing on the floor below, it looked perfectly proportioned. They understood optics.
The sophistication is wild. But then you get to the shaft in Lascaux, and things just get weird.
The shaft is baffling. It's in a very deep, hard-to-reach part of the cave. The scene shows a bison that's been disemboweled. Its intestines are hanging out.
Gruesome.
And next to it is a man. But he's a stick figure with a bird's head. And we have to be accurate here. A prominent erection.
A dying bison, a bird man with an erection, and a bird on a stick next to it.
A bird on a staff, yes.
I mean, what is going on? Is it a joke? A story?
It's the only human figure in the whole cave. And it's a caricature. One theory is it's shamanistic. The bird is the flight of the soul in a trance. The erection represents the physical stress of that state. The bison is the spirit animal or sacrifice.
But why draw the animals so beautifully and the humans so crudely?
That connects to the reindeer mystery.
Oh, right. Remind me, they ate reindeer, didn't they?
It was their staple food. We find mountains of reindeer bones. But they almost never painted reindeer. They painted lions, rhinos, bulls. Dangerous animals.
They didn't paint their menu.
No. And they didn't paint themselves realistically. It suggests the art was about reverence. They painted what they respected or feared. Maybe capturing a human likeness was taboo.
Like it would steal your soul.
Possibly. Or maybe it was just seen as arrogant.
Before we get to the big twist, I want to touch on one last thing from the caves. The hand stencils.
The Cave of Hands. It's so simple, but so powerful.
Put your hand on the wall, blow pigment over it. It hits me harder than the most beautiful bison.
Because it's an autograph. It's I was here. But look where they put them. Often over cracks in the rock or holes leading deeper into the cave.
Like a portal.
Many anthropologists think they saw the cave wall as a membrane between our world and the spirit world. By placing your hand there, you were touching the other side, making contact.
That gives me chills. Okay, so we've been talking about us this whole time, Homo sapiens, but there's a twist in the research that just upends that whole story.
The Neanderthal twist. For so long, the dogma was, sapiens make art, Neanderthals make crude tools. Art is what makes us special.
But the dating technology got better.
A lot better. We found a hashtag drawing in Blombos Cave in South Africa, a red ochre cross hatch pattern that's 73,000 years old. That's abstract thought. But then in Spain, we found cave paintings dated to 64,000 years ago.
And 64,000 years ago, Homo sapiens were not in Europe yet.
Correct, which leaves only one candidate. Neanderthals were painting the caves.
That changes everything. If they were making art, they had symbolic thought, they had language, they were us.
And we know now from genetics, we interbred. Everyone listening probably has 1-2% Neanderthal DNA.
So the creative explosion wasn't just us showing up and being brilliant.
It might have been a collaboration. Maybe we met them and learned from them or developed these ideas together. That solid line between us and them is just dissolving.
We've covered so much, from a beautiful hand axe to exploding pranks to cinematic caves. But if you have to boil it down, why? Why did they do all this?
I think we have to be careful not to look for one single answer. It wasn't just magic or just showing off or just a calendar.
It's messy.
It's human. But think about the Ice Age. Total darkness at night, constant danger. This art proves that just surviving wasn't enough for them. They needed to make sense of it all. They needed to externalize their fears, their stories.
It was a coping mechanism.
A cognitive necessity. It turns out we aren't the only ones who needed art to feel sane.
You know, I keep coming back to those hand stencils.
It's the image that sticks with everyone. Why do you think that is?
Because it's the exact same urge you see when a kid writes their name in wet cement or carves initials into a tree. It's this desperate need to shout into the void, I exist, I was here, I mattered.
And that urge apparently is older than our own species. If Neanderthals felt it, and we feel it, it might just be the most fundamental trait of consciousness. The moment you know you exist, you want to leave a mark.
And thanks to some red ochre in a dark cave, 40,000 years later, we can still see them waving back. That's a pretty beautiful place to leave it.
It certainly is.
Thanks for exploring the dark with us. We'll see you on the next deep dive.